He follows Bischoff's tracks through a film of snow, down the cobblestone street and onto the pier. Three men in black scramble out of their launch, onto the ladder up to the pier. They salute Bischoff, and then two of them embrace him. Shafto's close enough, and the salmon light is bright enough, that he can recognize these two, members of Bischoff's old crew. The third guy is taller, older, gaunter, grimmer, better dressed, more highly decorated. All in all, more of a Nazi. Shafto can't believe himself. When he picked up the locker, he was just being a Confederate to his friend Gunter, an ink-stained retiree with pacifist leanings. Now, all of a sudden, he's aiding and abetting the enemy. What would his fellow Marines think of him if they knew? Oh, yeah, almost forgot. He is actually participating in the conspiracy that he, Bischoff, Rudy von Heckelhaber, and Enoch Root created in the basement of that church. He comes to a dead stop and slams the locker down right there in the middle of the pier. The Nazi is startled by the noise and raises his blue eyes in the direction of Shafto, who prepares to stare him down. Bischoff notices this. He turns towards Shafto and shouts something cheerful in Swedish. Shafto has the presence of mind to break eye contact with the chilly German. He grins and nods back. This conspiracy thing is going to be a real pain in the ass if it means backing down from casual fistfights. A couple of sailors have come up the ladder now to handle Bischoff's luggage. One of them strides down the pier to get the footlocker. Shafto recognizes him, and he recognizes Shafto at the same moment. Damn! The guy is surprised, but not unpleasantly so, to see Shafto here. Then something occurs to him, and his face freezes up in horror, and his eyes dart sideways back toward the tall Nazi. Shit! Shafto turns his back on all of this, makes like he's strolling back into town. Jens! Jens! Bischoff hollers, and then says something else in Swedish. He's running after Shafto. Shafto keeps his back prudently turned until Bischoff throws one arm around him with a final, Jens! Then, sotto voce in English, you have my family's address. If I don't see you in Manila, let's get in touch after the war. He starts pounding Shafto on the back, pulls some paper money out of his pocket, stuffs it into Shafto's hand.
God damn it, you'll see me there, Shafto says. What is this shit for?
I am tipping the nice Swedish boy who carried my luggage, Bischoff says.
Shafto sucks his teeth and grimaces. He can tell he is not cut out for this cloak-and-dagger nonsense. Questions come to his mind. Among them, how is that big torpedo full of rocket fuel safer than what you were riding around in before? But he just says,
Good luck, I guess.
Godspeed, my friend, Bischoff says. This will remind you to check your mail.
Then he punches Shafto in the shoulder hard enough to raise a 3-day welt, turns around and begins walking towards salt water. Shafto walks towards snow and trees, envying him. The next time he looks at the harbor, 15 minutes later, the U-boat is gone. Suddenly this town feels just as cold, empty, and out in the middle of nowhere as it really is. He's been getting his mail at the Norsbrook post office, general delivery. When the place opens up a couple of hours later, Shafto's waiting by the door, venting steam from his nostrils, like he's rocket fuel-powered. He receives a letter from his folks in Wisconsin, and one large envelope posted yesterday from somewhere in Norsbrook, Sweden, bearing no return address but inscribed in Gunter Bischoff's hand. It is full of notes and documents concerning the new U-boat, including one or two letters personally signed by John Hancock himself. Shafto's German is slightly better than it was before he went on his own U-boat ride, but he still can't follow most of it. He sees a lot of numbers there, a lot of technical-looking stuff. It is your basic, priceless naval intelligence. Shafto wraps the papers up carefully, sticks them in his pants, begins walking up the beach towards the Gavistic residence. It is a long, cold, wet trudge. He has plenty of time to assess his situation. stuck in a neutral country on the other side of the world from where he wants to be, alienated from the core, lumped in with a vague conspiracy. Technically speaking, he has been AWOL for several months now, but if he suddenly turns up at the American Embassy in Stockholm carrying these documents, all will be forgiven. So this is his ticket home. And home is a very large country that includes places like Hawaii, which is closer to Manila than is Norsbrook, Sweden. Otto's boat is fresh in from Finland, bobbing on an incoming tide, tied up to his bird's nest of a jetty. The boat, he knows, is still loaded up with whatever Finns are exchanging for coffee and bullets at the moment. Otto himself is sitting in the cabin, drinking coffee, naturally, red-eyed and plumb wrung out.
"Where's Julietta?" Shafto says.
He's starting to worry that she moved back to Finland or something. Otto turns a bit grayer every time he drives his tub across the Gulf of Bothnia. He looks especially gray today.
"Did you see that monster?"
he says, then shakes his head in a combination of wonderment, disgust, and world weariness that can only be attained by hardened Finns.
"Those German bastards. I thought they were protecting you from the Russians."
This elicits a long thunder roll of dark, chortling laughter from Otto.
"Zadrastoitetje, tovarish,"
he finally says.
"Say what?" "That means welcome, comrade, in Russian,"
Otto says.
"I have been practicing it."
"You should be practicing the Pledge of Allegiance," Shafto says. "Soon as we get done taking down the Germans, I figure we'll just kick her into high gear and beat the Ruskies all the way back to Siberia."
More laughter from Otto, who knows naivete when he sees it, but is not above finding it charming.
"I have buried the German air turbine in Finland," he says. "I will sell it to the Russians or the Americans, whoever gets there first."
"Where's Julietta?"
Shafto asks again. Speaking of naivete.
"In town,"
Otto says.
"Shopping. So you got cash."
Otto looks seasick. Tomorrow is payday. Then Shafto's going to be on a bus headed for Stockholm. Shafto sits down across from Otto and they drink coffee and talk about weather, smuggling, and the relative merits of various small, fully automatic weapons for a while. Actually, what they are talking about is whether Shafto will get paid and how much. In the end, Otto issues a guarded promise to pay, provided that Julietta does not spend all of the money on her shopping trip, and provided that Shafto unloads the boat. So Bobby Shafto spends the rest of the day carrying Soviet mortars, rusty tins of caviar, bricks of black tea from China, lap folk art, a couple of icons, cases of pine-flavored Finnish schnapps, coils of vile sausages and bundles of pelts up out of the hold of Otto's boat, down the dock, into the cabin. Meanwhile, Otto goes into town and still has not come back long after night has fallen. Shafto sacks out in the cabin, tosses and turns for about 4 hours, sleeps for about 10 minutes, and then is awakened by a knocking at the door. He approaches the door on hands and knees, gets the Suomi machine pistol out of its hiding place, then crawls to the far end of the cabin and exits silently through a trap door in the floor. There is ice on the rocks below, but his bare feet give him enough traction to clamber around and get a good view of whoever is standing there pounding on the door. It is Enoch Root himself, nowhere to be seen this last week or so.
"Yo,"
Shafto says.
"Bobby," Root says, turning around. "I gather you heard."
"Heard what?"
"That we are in danger."
"Nah,"
Shafto says.
"This is just how I always answer the door."
They go into the cabin. Root declines to turn on any lights and keeps looking out the windows like he's expecting someone. He smells faintly of Julietta's perfume, a distinctive scent that Otto has been smuggling into Finland by the 55-gallon drum. Somehow, Shafto is not surprised by this. He proceeds to make coffee.
"A very complex situation has arisen," Root says.
"I can see that."
Root is startled by this and looks up blankly at Shafto, his eyes glowing stupidly in the moonlight. You can be the smartest guy in the world, but when a woman comes into the picture, you're just like any other sap.
Did you come all this way to tell me that you're fucking Julietta?
Oh, no, 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 Root says. He stops for a moment, furrows his brow.
Oh, I mean, I am, and I was going to tell you, but that's just the first part of a more complicated business.
Root gets up, shoves hands in pockets, walks around the cabin again, looking out the windows.
You have any more of those finished guns?
In that crate to your left,
Shafto says.
Why? We gonna have a shootout?
Maybe. Not between you and me, but other visitors may be coming.
Cops?
Worse.
Fins?
Because Otto has his rivals.
Worse.
Well, who then?
Shafto can't imagine worse.
Germans. German.
Oh, fuck.
Shafto hollers disgustedly.
How can you say they're worse than Fins?
Root looks taken aback.
If you're going to tell me that Finns are worse, pound for pound, than Germans, then I agree with you. But the trouble with Germans is that they tend to be in communication with millions of other Germans.
Okay,
Shafto mutters. Root hauls the lid off a crate, pulls out a machine pistol, checks the chamber, aims the barrel at the moon, peers through it like a telescope.
In any case, some Germans are coming to kill you.
Why?
Because you know too much about certain things.
What certain things? Gunter and his new submarine?
Yes.
And how, may I ask, do you know this? It has something to do with the fact that you're fucking Julietta, right?
Shafto continues. He's bored rather than pissed off. This whole Sweden thing is old and tired to him now. He belongs in the Philippines. Anything that doesn't get him closer to the Philippines just irritates him.
Right.
Root heaves a sigh.
She thinks highly of you, Bobby. But after she saw that picture of your girlfriend...
Snap out of it! She doesn't give a shit about you or me. She just wants to have all of the good parts of being a Finn without the bad parts.
What are the bad parts?
Having to live in Finland,
Shafto says.
So she has to marry someone with a good passport, which nowadays means American or British. You might have noticed that she didn't fuck Gunter.
Root looks a little queasy.
Well, maybe she did then,
Shafto says, heaving a sigh.
Shit.
Root has rooted an ammo clip out of another crate and figured out how to affix it to the Suomi. He says,
You probably know that the Germans have a tacit arrangement with the Swedes.
What does tacit mean?
Well, let's just say they have an arrangement.
The Swedes are neutral, but they let the Krauts push them around.
Yes. Otto has to deal with Germans at the end of his smuggling route, in Sweden and in Finland, and he has to deal with their navy when he's out on the water.
I'm aware that the fucking Germans are all over Europe.
Well, to make a long story short, the local Germans have prevailed upon Otto to betray you,
Root says.
Did he?
Yes, he did betray you.
Okay, keep talking, I'm listening to you,
Shafto says. He begins to mount a ladder up into the attic.
But then he thought better of it. I guess you could say he repented, Root says.
Spoken like a true man of the cloth,
Shafto mutters. He's into the attic now, crawling on hands and knees over the rafters. He stops and sparks up his Zippo. Most of its light is absorbed by a dark green slab, a crude wooden crate with Cyrillic letters stenciled on it. Root's voice is filtering up from below.
He came to... the place where Juliet and I, were
fucking.
Get me the crowbar,
Shafto shouts.
It's in Otto's toolbox under the table.
A minute later, the crowbar rises up through the hatch like the head of a cobra emerging from a basket. Shafto grabs it and begins assaulting the crate.
Otto was torn. He had to do what he did, or the German could have shut down his livelihood. But he respects you. He couldn't bear it. He had to talk to someone. So he came to us and told Julietta what he had done. Julietta understood.
She understood?
But she also was horrified at the same time.
That is truly heartwarming.
At that point, the Kvistics broke out the schnapps and began to discuss the situation. In Finnish.
I understand,
Shafto says. Give those Finns a grim, stark, bleak moral dilemma and a bottle of schnapps, and you could pretty much forget about them for 48 hours.
Thanks for having the guts to come out here.
Julietta will understand.
That's not what I mean.
Oh, I don't think Otto would hurt me.
No, I mean...
Oh! Root exclaims. No, I had to tell you about Julietta sooner or later.
No, goddammit, I mean the Germans!
Oh. Well, I didn't even begin to think about them until I was almost here. It was not courage so much as a lack of foresight. Shafto is pretty good at foresight.
Take this.
He hands down a heavy steel tube of coffee can diameter, a few feet long.
It's heavy,
he adds, as Root's knees buckle.
Oh, what is it?
A Soviet 120-millimeter mortar,
Shafto says.
Oh.
Root remains silent for a while as he lays the mortar down on the table. When he speaks again, his voice sounds different.
I didn't realize Otto had this kind of stuff.
The lethal radius of this bitch is a good 60 feet,
Shafto says. He is hauling mortar bombs out of the crate and stacking them next to the hatch.
Or maybe it's meters, I can't remember.
The bombs look like fat footballs with tail fins on one end.
Feet, meters, the distinction is important,
Root says.
Maybe it's overkill, but we have to get back to Norsbrook and take care of Julietta.
What do you mean, take care of her?
Root says warily.
Marry her.
What?
One of us has to marry her, and fast. I don't know about you, but I kind of like her, and it'd be a shame if she spent the rest of her life sucking Russian dick at gunpoint,
Shafto says.
Besides, she might be pregnant with one of our kids, yours, mine, or Gunter's.
We, the conspiracy, have an obligation to look after our offspring,
Root agrees.
We could establish a trust fund for them in London.
There should be plenty of money for that,
Shafto agrees.
But I can't marry her, because I have to be available to marry Glory when I get to Manila.
Rudy can't do it,
Root says.
Because he's a fag?
No, they marry women all the time,
Root says.
He can't do it because he's German. And what's he going to do with a German passport?
It would not be savvy, exactly,
Shafto agrees.
That leaves me,
Root says.
I'll marry her, and she'll have a British passport. Best in the world.
Huh,
Shafto says.
Well, how does that square with your being a celibate monk or priest or whatever the fuck you supposedly are?
Root says, I'm supposed to be celibate.
But you're not,
Shafto reminds him.
But God's forgiveness is infinite,
Root fires back, winning the point.
So, as I was saying, I'm supposed to be celibate, but that doesn't mean I can't get married, as long as I don't consummate the marriage.
But if you don't consummate it, it doesn't count.
But the only person besides me who will know that we didn't consummate it is Julietta.
God will know,
Shafto says.
God doesn't issue passports,
Root says.
What about the church? They'll kick you out.
Maybe I deserve to be kicked out.
So let me get this straight,
Shafto says.
When you really were fucking Julietta, you said you weren't, and so you were able to remain a priest. Now you're gonna marry her and not fuck her and say that you are?
If you're trying to say that my relationship with the church is very complicated, I already knew that, Bobby.
Let's go then,
Shafto says. Shafto and Root haul the mortar and a boxload of bombs down onto the beach, where they can take cover behind a stone retaining wall a good 5 feet high. But the surf makes it impossible to hear anything, so Root goes up and hides in the trees along the road and leaves Shafto to fiddle with the Soviet mortar. There turns out to be not much fiddling necessary. An unlettered tundra farmer with bilateral frostbite could get this thing up and running in 10 minutes. If he'd stayed up late the night before, celebrating the fulfillment of the last 5-year plan with a jug of wood alcohol, maybe 15 minutes. Shafto consults the instructions. It does not matter that these are printed in Russian, because they are made for illiterates anyway. A series of parabolas is plotted out, the mortar supporting one leg, and exploding Germans supporting the other. Ask a Soviet designer to design a pair of shoes and he'll come up with something that looks like the boxes that the shoes came in. Ask him to make something that will massacre Germans and he turns into Thomas fucking Edison. Shafto scans the terrain, picks out his killing zone, then climbs up and paces off the distance, assuming 1 meter per pace. He's back down on the beach, adjusting the tube's angle, when he's startled by a bulky form vaulting over the wall so close it almost knocks him down. Roots breathing fast.
Germans, he says, coming in from the main road.
How do you know they're Germans? Maybe it's Otto.
The engines sound like diesels. Huns love diesels.
How many engines?
Probably two.
Root turns out to be right on the money. Two large black Mercedes issue from the forest, like bad ideas emerging from the dim mind of a green lieutenant. Their headlights are not illuminated. Each stops and then sits there for a moment. Then the doors open quietly. Germans climb out and stand up. Several of them are wearing long black leather coats. Several are carrying those keen submachine guns that are the trademark of German infantry and the envy of Yanks and Tommies who must go burdened with primeval hunting rifles. This is the moment, then. Nazis are right over there, and it is the job of Bobby Shafto and, to a lesser degree, Enoch Root, to kill them all. Not just a job, but a moral requisite, because they are the living avatars of Satan, who publicly acknowledge being just as bad and vicious as they really are. It is a world and a situation to which Shafto and a lot of other people are perfectly adapted. He heaves a bomb up out of the box, introduces it to the muzzle of the fat tube, lets it go, and plugs his ears. The mortar coughs like a kettle drum. The Germans look towards them. An officer's monocle glints in the moonlight. A total of 8 Germans have gotten out of the cars. 3 of them must be combat veterans because they are down on their stomachs in a microsecond. The trench-coated officers remain standing, as do a couple of civilian-clad goons, who immediately open fire in their general direction with their submachine guns. This makes a lot of noise, but only impresses Shafto insofar as it is an impressive display of stupidity. The bullets sail far over their heads. Before they have had time to pepper the Gulf of Bothnia, the mortar bomb has exploded. Shafto peers over the top of the seawall. As he more or less expected, all of the people who were standing up are now draped over the nearer Mercedes, having been bodily lifted off their feet and flung sideways by a moving curtain of shrapnel. But 2 of the survivors, the veterans, are belly-crawling towards Otto's cabin, whose thick log walls look extremely reassuring in these circumstances. The 3rd survivor is blasting away with his submachine gun, but he has no idea where they are. The ground is convex in a way that makes it hard to see those belly-crawling Germans. Shafto fires a couple more mortar rounds without much effect. He hears the 2 Germans kicking down the door to Otto's cabin. Since it is only a 1-room cabin, this would be a fine moment to be armed with grenades. But Shafto has none, and he doesn't really want to blow the place up anyway.
"Why don't you kill the 1 German up there?"
he tells Root, and then heads down the beach, hugging the seawall in case the Germans are looking out the windows. Indeed, when he's almost there, the Germans smash the windows out and begin firing in the direction of Enoch Root. Shafto creeps underneath the cabin, opens the trap door, and emerges into the center of the room. The Germans are standing there with their backs to him. He fires his Suomi into their backs until they stop moving. Then he drags them over to the trap door and dumps them down onto the beach so they won't bleed all over the floor. The next high tide will carry them away, and with any luck, they'll wash ashore on the fatherland in a couple of weeks. It is silent now, the way it's supposed to be at an isolated cabin by the sea, but that doesn't mean anything. Shafto makes his way carefully up into the trees and circles around behind the action, surveying the killing zone from above. The 1 German is still crawling around on his elbows, trying to figure out what's going on. Shafto kills him. Then he makes his way down to the beach and finds Enoch Root bleeding into the sand. He has taken a bullet just under the collarbone, and there is a lot of blood, both from the wound and from Root's mouth, whenever he exhales.
I feel like I'm going to die, he says.
Good,
Shafto says.
That means you probably won't.
One of the Mercedes automobiles is still functional, though it has a number of shrapnel holes and a flat tire. Shafto jacks it up and swaps in a surviving tire from the other Mercedes, then drags Root over and gets him laid out in the back seat. He drives into Norsbrook fast. The Mercedes is a really great car, and he wants to drive it all the way to Finland, Russia, Siberia, down through China, maybe stop for a little sushi in Shanghai, then on down through Siam and then Malaya, whence he could hop a sea gypsy's boat to Manila, find glory, and... The ensuing erotic reverie is cut short by the voice of Enoch Root, bubbling through blood or something.
God to the church.
Now, Padre, there's no time to be trying to convert me into a religious nut. You take it easy.
No. Go now. Take me.
What? So you can make your peace with God? Hell, Rev, you ain't gonna die. I'll take you to the doctors. You can go to church later.
Root drifts off into a coma, mumbling something about cigars. Shafto ignores these ravings, burns rubber into Norsbrook, and wakes up the doctor. Then he goes and finds Otto and Julietta and takes them over to the doctor's office. Finally, he goes round to the church and wakes up the minister. When they get back to the clinic, Rudolf von Heckelhaber's arguing with the doctor. Rudy, who is apparently speaking on behalf of Enoch, who can hardly even talk, wants Enoch's wedding to Julietta to happen now, in case Enoch dies on the table. Shafto is startled by how bad the patient suddenly looks. But remembering what he and Enoch talked about earlier, he weighs in on Rudy's side and insists that marriage must come before surgery. Otto produces a diamond ring, literally out of his asshole. He carries valuables around in a polished metal tube shoved up his rectum, and Shafto serves as best man, uneasily holding that ring, still hot from Otto. Root's too weak to thread it over Julietta's finger, and so Rudy guides his hands. A nurse serves as bridesmaid. Julietta and Enoch are joined in holy matrimony. Root utters the words of the oath one at a time, pausing after each one to cough blood into a stainless steel bowl. Shafto gets all choked up and actually sniffles. The doctor etherizes Root, opens his chest, and goes in to repair the damage. Combat surgery isn't his métier, and so he makes a few mistakes and generally does a great job of keeping the tension level high. Some major artery gives way, and it's necessary for Shafto and the minister to go out and yank Swedes off the streets and persuade them to donate blood. Rudy is nowhere to be found, and Shafto suspects for a few minutes that he has blown town. But then suddenly he shows up at Root's bedside, holding an ancient Cuban cigar box, Spanish words all over it. When Enoch Root dies, the only other people in the room are Rudolf von Heckelhaber, Bobby Shafto, and the Swedish doctor. The doctor checks his watch, then steps out of the room. Rudy reaches out and closes Enoch's eyes, then stands there with his hand on the late Padre's face and looks at Shafto.
Go, he says. But make sure that the doctor files the death certificate.
In war, it happens pretty frequently that one of your buddies dies and you have to go right back into action and save the waterworks for later.
Right,
Shafto says, and leaves the room. The doctor's sitting in his little office, umlaut-studded diplomas all over the walls, filling out the death certificate. A skeleton dangles in one corner. Bobby Shafto stands at attention on the opposite flank, he and the skeleton sort of triangulating on the doctor and watching him scrawl out the date and time of Enoch Root's demise. When the doctor's finished, he leans back in his chair and rubs his eyes.
Can I buy you a cup of coffee?
Asks Bobby Shafto.
Thank you, says the doctor.
The young bride and her father are sprawled blearily in the doctor's waiting room. Shafto offers to buy them coffee, too. They leave Rudy to keep watch over the body of their late friend and co-conspirator and walk down the high street of Norsbrook. Swedish people are beginning to come out of their houses. They look exactly like American Midwesterners, and Shafto's always startled when they fail to speak English. The doctor stops in at the courthouse to drop off the death certificate. Otto and Julietta go on ahead to the café. Bobby Shafto loiters outside, staring back up the street. After a minute or two, he sees Rudy poke his head out the door of the doctor's office and look one way, then the other. He pulls his head back inside for a moment. Then he and another man walk out of the office. The other man is wrapped in a blanket that covers even his head. They climb into the Mercedes. Blanket Man lies down in the back seat, and Rudy drives off in the direction of his cottage. Bobby Shafto sits down in the cafe with the Finns.
Later today I'm going to get into that fucking Mercedes and drive into Stockholm like a fucking bat out of hell,
Shafto says. Though the Finns will never appreciate it, he has chosen the bat out of hell phrase for a good reason. He understands now why he has thought of himself as a dead man ever since Guadalcanal.
Anyway, I hope you all have a nice boat ride.
Boat ride? Otto says innocently.
I gave you up to the Germans, just like you did to me,
Shafto lies.
You bastard!
Julietta begins, but Bobby cuts her off.
You got what you wanted and then some. A British passport and...
Glancing out the window, he sees the doctor emerging from the courthouse.
Enoch survivor's benefits on top of it. Maybe more later. As for you, Otto, your career as a smuggler is over. I suggest you get the fuck out of here.
Otto's still flabbergasted to be outraged, but he's sure enough gonna be outraged pretty soon.
And go where? Have you bothered to look at a map?
I'll display some fucking adaptability,
Shafto says.
You can figure out a way to get that tub of yours to England.
Say what you will about Otto, he likes a challenge.
I could traverse the Goethe Canal from Stockholm to Göteborg. No Germans there. That would get me almost to Norway, but Norway's full of Germans. Even if I make it through the Skagerrak, you expect me to cross the North Sea in winter during a war?
If it makes you feel any better, after you get to England, you have to sail to Manila.
Manila?
Makes England seem easy, huh?
You think I am a rich yachtsman who sails around the world for fun?
No, but Rudolf von Heckelhaber is. He's got money. He's got connections. He's got a line on a good yacht that makes your catch look like a dinghy,
Shafto says.
Come on, Otto, stop whining. Pull some more diamonds out of your asshole and get it done. It beats being tortured to death by Germans.
Shafto stands up and chucks Otto encouragingly on the shoulder, which Otto does not like at all.
See you in Manila.
The doctor's coming in the door. Bobby Shafto slaps some money down on the table. He looks Julietta in the eye.
Got some miles to cover now,
he says.
Glory's waiting for me.
Julietta nods. So in the eyes of one Finnish girl, anyway, Shafto's not such a bad guy. He bends over and gives her a big, succulent kiss, then straightens up, nods to the startled doctor, and walks out. Courting. Waterhouse has been chewing his way through exotic NIP code systems at the rate of about one a week, but after he sees Mary Smith in the parlor of Mrs. McTeague's boarding house, his production rate drops to near zero. Arguably, it goes negative, for sometimes when he reads the morning newspaper, its plain text scrambles into gibberish before his eyes, and he is unable to extract any useful information. Despite his and Turing's disagreements about whether the human brain is a Turing machine, he has to admit that Turing wouldn't have too much trouble writing a set of instructions to stimulate the brain functions of Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse. Waterhouse seeks happiness. He achieves it by breaking NIP code systems and playing the pipe organ. But since pipe organs are in short supply, his happiness level ends up being totally dependent on breaking codes. He cannot break codes, hence cannot be happy, unless his mind is clear. Now, suppose that mental clarity is designated by C sub M, which is normalized or calibrated in such a way that it is always the case that 0, which is less than or equal to C sub M, which is less than 1. Where C sub M equals 0 indicates a totally clouded mind, and C sub M equals 1 is godlike clarity, an unattainable divine state of infinite intelligence. If the number of messages water decrypts in a given day is governed by C sub M, when C sub M is low, the number of decrypts is extremely low. As C sub M rises, so does the number of decrypts. And as C sub M approaches 1, the number of decrypts soars exponentially, blowing right out of the top of the graph. Clarity of mind, C sub M, is affected by any number of factors, but by far the most important is horniness. Waterhouse designates this with a lowercase sigma because of that Greek letter's obvious similarity to the male genitalia, which he finds amusing at this stage of his emotional development. Horniness, sigma, begins at 0 immediately following ejaculation and increases from there. The only way to drop it back to 0 is to arrange another ejaculation. There is a critical threshold, sigma sub C, such that when sigma exceeds sigma sub C, it becomes impossible for Waterhouse to concentrate on anything, much less break Nipponese cryptographic systems. This makes it impossible for him to achieve happiness, unless there is a pipe organ handy, which there isn't. Typically, it takes 2 to 3 days for sigma to climb above sigma sub C after an ejaculation. Critical, then, to the maintenance of Waterhouse's sanity is the ability to ejaculate every 2 to 3 days. As long as he can arrange this, sigma exhibits a classic sawtooth wave pattern, optimally within the peaks at or near sigma sub C, beyond which he is completely useless to the war effort. So much for the basic theory. Now, when he was at Pearl Harbor, he discovered something that, in retrospect, should have been profoundly disquieting. Namely, that ejaculations obtained in a whorehouse, that is, provided by the ministrations of an actual human female, seemed to drop sigma below the level that Waterhouse could achieve through executing a manual override. In other words, the post-ejaculatory horniness level was not always equal to 0, as the naive theory propounded before assumes, but to some other quantity dependent upon whether the ejaculation was induced by self or other. Sigma equals sigma sub self after masturbation, but sigma equals sigma sub other upon leaving a whorehouse, where sigma sub self is greater than sigma sub other, an inequality to which Waterhouse's notable successes in breaking certain NIP naval codes at Station Hypo were directly attributable, in that the many convenient whorehouses nearby made it possible for him to go somewhat longer between ejaculations. During the 12-day period, 19 to 30 May, 1942, Waterhouse had been able to make tactical use of this insight, arranging things so that he suffered only one brief interruption in productivity, during which he, some might argue, personally won the Battle of Midway. If he had thought about this, it would have bothered him because sigma sub self is greater than sigma sub other has troubling implications, particularly if the values of these quantities, WRT, the all-important sigma sub C, are not fixed. If it weren't for this inequality, then Waterhouse could function as a totally self-contained and independent unit. But sigma sub self is greater than sigma sub other implies that he is, in the long run, dependent on other human beings for his mental clarity and, therefore, his happiness. What a pain in the ass. Perhaps he has avoided thinking about this precisely because it is so troubling. The week after he meets Mary Smith, he realizes that he is going to have to think about it a lot more. Something about the arrival of Mary Smith on the scene has completely fouled up the whole system of equations. Now, when he has an ejaculation, his clarity of mind does not take the upwards jump that it should. He goes right back to thinking about Mary. So much for winning the war. He goes out in search of whorehouses, hoping that good old reliable sigma sub other will save his bacon. This is troublesome. When he was at Pearl, it was easy and uncontroversial. But Mrs. McTeague's boarding house is in a residential neighborhood, which, if it contains whorehouses, at least bothers to hide them. So Waterhouse has to travel downtown, which is not that easy in a place where internal combustion vehicles are fueled by barbecues in the trunk. Furthermore, Mrs. McTeague is keeping her eye on him. She knows his habits. If he starts coming back from work 4 hours late or going out after dinner, he'll have some explaining to do. And it had better be convincing because she happens to have taken Mary Smith under one quivering gelatinous wing and is in a position to poison the sweet girl's mind against Waterhouse. Not only that, He has to do much of his excuse-making in public at the dinner table, which he shares with Mary's cousin, whose first name turns out to be Rod. But hey,
do a little bomb Tokyo, didn't he?
Waterhouse should at least be able to sneak out to a whorehouse. It takes a week of preparations, during which he is completely unable to accomplish meaningful work because of the soaring Sigma level, but he manages it. It helps a little, but only on the Sigma management level. Until recently, that was the only level, and so it would have been fine, but now, as Waterhouse realizes, through long contemplation during the hours when he should be breaking codes, a new factor has entered the system of equations that governs his behavior. He will have to write to Alan and tell him that some new instructions will have to be added to the Waterhouse simulation Turing machine. This new factor is F sub MSP, the factor of Mary Smith proximity. In a simpler universe, F sub MSP would be orthogonal to Sigma, which is to say that the two factors would be entirely independent of each other. If it were thus, Waterhouse could continue the usual sawtooth wave ejaculation management program with no changes. In addition, he would have to arrange to have frequent conversations with Mary Smith so that F sub MSP would remain as high as possible. Alas, the universe is not simple. Far from being orthogonal, F sub MSP and Sigma are involved as elaborately as the contrails of dogfighting airplanes. The old Sigma management scheme doesn't work anymore, and a platonic relationship will actually make F sub MSP worse, not better. His life, which used to be a straightforward set of basically linear equations, has become a differential equation. It is the visit to the whorehouse that makes him realize this. In the Navy, going to a whorehouse is about as controversial as pissing down the scuppers when you are on the high seas. The worst you can say about it is that in other circumstances it might seem uncouth. So Waterhouse has been doing it for years without feeling troubled in the slightest. But he loathes himself during and after his first post-Mary Smith whorehouse visit. He no longer sees himself through his own eyes, but through hers, and by extension those of her cousin Rod, and of Mrs. McTeague, and of the whole society of decent God-fearing folk, to whom he has never paid the slightest bit of attention until now. It seems that the intrusion of F sub MSP into his happiness equation is just the thin edge of a wedge which leaves Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse at the mercy of a vast number of uncontrollable factors and requiring him to cope with normal human society. Horrifyingly, he now finds himself getting ready to go to a dance. The dance is being organized by an Australian volunteer organization. He doesn't know or care about the details. Mrs. McTeague evidently feels that the rent she collects from her boarders obligates her to find them wives as well as feeding and housing them, so she badgers all of them to go, and to bring dates if possible. Rod finally shuts her up by announcing that he will be attending with a large group, to include his country cousin Mary. Rod is about 8 feet tall, and so it will be easy to pick him out across a crowded dance floor. With any luck, then, the diminutive Mary will be in his vicinity. So Waterhouse goes to the dance, ransacking his mind for opening lines that he can use with Mary. He comes up with several possibilities. Do you realize that Nipponese industry is only capable of producing 40 bulldozers per year? To be followed up with, no wonder they use slave labor to build their revetments. Or, because of antenna configuration limitations inherent in their design, Nipponese naval radar systems have a blind spot to the rear. You always want to come in from dead astern. Or, the Nip Army's minor low-level codes are actually harder to break than the important high-level ones. Isn't that ironic? Or, so, you're from the Outback. Do you can a lot of your own food? It might interest you to know that a close relative of the bacterium that makes canned soup go bad is responsible for gas gangrene. Or, Nip battleships have started to blow up spontaneously because the high explosive shells in their magazines become chemically unstable over time. Or, Dr. Turing of Cambridge says that the soul is an illusion and that all that defines us as human beings can be reduced to a series of mechanical operations. And much more in this vein. So far, he has not hit on anything that is absolutely guaranteed to sweep her off her feet. He doesn't, in fact, have the first idea what the fuck he's going to do. Which is how it's always been with Waterhouse and women, which is why he has never really had a girlfriend before. But this is different. This is desperation. What is there to say about the dance? Big room, men in uniforms, mostly looking smarter than they have a right to, mostly looking smarter, in fact, than Waterhouse. Women in dresses and hairdos, lipstick, pearls, a big band, white gloves, fistfights, a little bit of kissing and a wee bit of vomiting. Waterhouse gets there late, that transportation thing again. All the gasoline is being used to hurl enormous bombers through the atmosphere so that high explosives can be showered on Nips. Moving the wad of flesh called Waterhouse across Brisbane so he can try to deflower a maiden is way down the priority list. He has to do a lot of walking in his stiff, shiny leather shoes, which become less shiny. By the time he gets there, he is pretty sure that they are functioning only as tourniquets, preventing uncontrollable arterial bleeding from the wounds they've induced. Rather late into the dance, he finally picks out Rod on the dance floor and stalks him over the course of several numbers, Rod having no shortage of dance partners, to a corner of the room where everyone seems to know each other and all of them seem to be having a perfectly fine time without the intervention of a Waterhouse. But finally, he identifies Mary Smith's neck, which looks just as unspeakably erotic seen from behind through 30 yards of dense cigarette smoke as it did seen from the side in Mrs. McTeague's parlor. She is wearing a dress and a string of pearls that adorn the neck's architecture quite nicely. Waterhouse sets his direction of march towards her and plods onward like a marine covering the last few yards to a Nip pillbox where he knows full well he's going to die. Can you get a posthumous decoration for being shot down in flames at a dance? He's just a few paces away, still forging along woozily towards that white column of neck, when suddenly the tune comes to an end and he can hear Mary's voice and the voices of her friends. They are chattering away happily, but they are not speaking English. Finally, Waterhouse places that accent. Not only that, he solves another mystery, having to do with some incoming mail he has seen at Mrs. McTeague's house, addressed to someone named Skimith. It's like this. Rod and Mary are Tagmian, and their family name is not Smith. It just sounds vaguely like Smith. It's really Skimith. Rod grew up in Manchester, in some Tagmian ghetto, no doubt, and Mary's from a branch of the family that got into trouble, probably sedition, a couple of generations back and got transported to the Great Sandy Desert. Let's see Turing explain this one. Because what this proves, beyond all doubt, is that there is a God. And furthermore, that he is a personal friend and supporter of Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse. The opening line problem is solved, neat as a theorem, QED, baby! Waterhouse strides forward confidently, sacrificing another square centimeter of epidermis to his ravenous shoes. As he later reconstructs it, he has, without meaning to, interpolated himself between Mary's committed and her date, and perhaps jostled the latter's elbow and forced him to spill his drink. It is a startling move that quiets the group. Waterhouse opens his mouth and says, "Gissen blended oskidma."
"Hi, friend," says Mary's date.
Waterhouse turns towards the sound of the voice. The sloppy grin draped across his face serves as a convenient bullseye, and Mary's date's fist homes in on it unerringly. The bottom half of Waterhouse's head goes numb. His mouth fills with a warm fluid that tastes nutritious. The vast concrete floor somehow takes to the air, spins like a flipped coin, and bounces off the side of his head. All four of Waterhouse's limbs seem to be pinned against the floor by the weight of his torso. Some sort of commotion is happening up on that remote plane of most people's heads, 5 to 6 feet above the floor, where social interaction traditionally takes place. Mary's date is being hustled off to the side by a large, powerful fellow. It is hard to recognize faces from this angle, but a good candidate would be Rod. Rod is shouting in Tagmian. Actually, everyone is shouting in Tagmian,
even the ones who are speaking in English, because Waterhouse's speech recognition centers have a bad case of jangly ganglia. Best to leave that fancy stuff for later and concentrate on more basic phylogenesis. It would be nice, for example, to be a vertebrate again. After that, quadrupedal locomotion might come in handy. A perky Tagmian Australian fellow in an RAAF uniform steps up and grabs his right anterior fin, jerking him up the evolutionary ladder before he's ready. He is not doing Waterhouse a favor so much as he is getting Waterhouse's face up where it can be better scrutinized. The RAAF fellow shouts at him because the music has started again.
Where'd you learn to talk like that?
Waterhouse doesn't know where to begin. God forbid he should offend these people again. But he doesn't have to. The RAF guy screws up his face in disgust, as if he had just noticed a 6-foot tapeworm trying to escape from Waterhouse's throat.
How to tag him?
He asks. Waterhouse nods. The confused and shocked faces before him collapse into graven masks. Inner Tagmians. Of course. The Inner Islanders are perennially screwed, hence have the best music, the most entertaining personalities, but are constantly being shipped off to Barbados to chop sugarcane or to Tasmania to chase sheep or to, well, to the Southwest Pacific to be pursued through the jungle by starving nymphs draped with live satchel charges. The RAF chap forces himself to smile, chucks Waterhouse gently on the shoulder. Someone in this group is going to have to take the unpleasant job of playing diplomat, smoothing it all over, and with the true Inner Tagmian's nose for a shit job, RAF boy has just volunteered.
With us, he explains brightly. What you just said isn't a polite greeting.
Oh, Waterhouse says. What did I say then?
You said that while you were down at the mill to lodge a complaint about a sack with a weak seam that sprung loose on Thursday, you were led to understand by the tone of the proprietor's voice that Mary's great aunt, a spinster who had a loose reputation as a younger woman, had contracted a fungal infection in her toenails.
There is a long silence. Then everyone speaks at once. Finally, a woman's voice breaks through the cacophony.
No, no!
Waterhouse looks. It's Mary.
I understood him to say that it was at the pub, and that he was there to apply for a job catching rats, and that it was my neighbor's dog that had come down with rabies.
He was at the Basilica for confession, the priest, and China.
Someone shouts from the back. Then everyone talks at once.
The dark side.
Mary's half-sister.
Leprosy.
Wednesday.
Complaining about a loud party.
There's a strong arm around Waterhouse's shoulders, turning him away from all of this. He cannot turn his head to see who owns this limb, because his vertebrae have again become unstacked. He figures out that it's Rod, notably taking his poor addled Yank roommate under his wing. Rod pulls a clean hanky from his pocket and puts it up to Waterhouse's mouth, then takes his hand away. The hanky sticks to his lip, which is now shaped like a barrage balloon. That's not the only decent thing he does. He even gets Waterhouse a drink and finds him a chair.
You know about the Navajos?
Rod asks.
Huh? Your Marines use Navajo Indians as radio operators. They can speak to each other in their own language, and the Nips have no idea what the fuck they're saying.
Oh, yeah. Heard about that,
Waterhouse says.
Winnie Churchill heard about those Navajos. Liked the idea. Wanted His Majesty's forces to do likewise. We don't have Navajos, but
you have Tagmians,
Waterhouse says.
There are two different programs underway,
Rod says.
Royal Navy is using Outer Tagmians. Army and Air Force are using Inner.
How's it working out?
Rod shrugs.
So-so. Tagmian is a very pithy language. Bears no relationship to English or Celtic. Its closest relatives are Kind, which is spoken by a tribe of pygmies in Madagascar, and a lute. Anyway, the pithier the better, right?
By all means, Waterhouse says. Less redundancy. Harder to break the code.
Problem is, if it's not exactly a dead language, then it's lying on a litter with a priest standing over it making the sign of the cross, you know?
Waterhouse nods.
So everyone hears it a little differently. Like just now, they heard your Outer Tagmian accent and assumed you were delivering an insult. But I could tell you were saying that you believed, based on a rumor you heard last Tuesday in the meat market, that Mary was convalescing normally and would be back on her feet within a week.
I was trying to say that she looked beautiful, Waterhouse protests.
Ah, Rod says.
Then you should have said,
Gissen blended it or skidded ma.
That's what I said.
No, you confused the mid-glottal with the frontal glottal, Rod says.
Honestly, Waterhouse says, can you tell them apart over a noisy radio?
No, Rod says. On the radio, we stick to the basics. Get in there and take that pillbox, or I'll fucking kill you. And that sort of thing.
Before much longer, the band has finished its last set, and the party's over.
Well, Waterhouse says, would you tell Mary what I really did mean to say?
Oh, I'm sure there's no need,
Rod says confidently.
Mary is a good judge of character. I'm sure she knows what you meant. Tagmians excel at nonverbal communication.
Waterhouse just barely restrains himself from saying, I guess you'd have to, which would probably just earn him another slug in the face. Rod shakes his hand and departs. Waterhouse, marooned by his shoes, hobbles out.
INRI Goto Dengo lies on a cot of woven rushes for 6 weeks, under a white cone of mosquito netting that stirs in the breezes from the windows. When there is a typhoon, the nurses clasp mother-of-pearl shutters over the windows, but mostly they are left open day and night. Outside the window, an immense stairway has been hand-carved up the side of a green mountain. When the sun shines, the new rice on those terraces fluoresces. Green light boils into the room like flames. He can see small, gnarled people in colorful clothes, transplanting rice seedlings and tinkering with the irrigation system. The wall of his room is plain, cream-colored plaster spanned with forking deltas of cracks, like the blood vessels on the surface of an eyeball. It is decorated only with a crucifix carved out of Napa wood in maniacal detail. Jesus' eyes are smooth orbs without pupil or iris, as in Roman statues. He hangs askew on the crucifix, arms stretched out, the ligaments probably pulled loose from their moorings now, the crooked legs broken by the butt of a Roman spear, unable to support the body. A pitted rusty iron nail transfixes each palm, and a third suffices for both feet. Goto Dengo notices after a while that the sculptor has arranged the three nails in a perfect equilateral triangle. He and Jesus spend many hours and days staring at each other through the white veil that hangs around the bed. When it shifts in the mountain breezes, Jesus seems to writhe. An open scroll is fixed to the top of the crucifix. It says INRI. Goto Dengo spends a long time trying to fathom this. I need rapid something? Initiate nail removal immediately? The veil parts, and a perfect young woman in a severe black and white habit is standing in the gap, radiant in the green light coming off the terraces, carrying a bowl of steaming water. She peels back his hospital gown and begins to sponge him off. Goto Dengo motions towards the crucifix and asks about it. Perhaps the woman has learned a little Nipponese. If she hears him, she gives no sign. She is probably deaf, or crazy, or both. The Christians are notorious for the way they dote on defective persons. Her gaze is fixed on Goto Dengo's body, which she swabs gently but implacably, one postage-stamp-sized bit at a time. Goto Dengo's mind is still playing tricks with him, and looking down at his naked torso, he gets all turned around for a moment and thinks that he is looking at the nailed wreck of Jesus. His ribs are sticking out, and his skin is a cluttered map of sores and scars. He cannot possibly be good for anything now. Why are they not sending him back to Nippon? Why haven't they simply killed him?
You speak English,
he says, and her huge brown eyes jump just a bit. She is the most beautiful woman he has ever seen.
To her, he must be a loathsome thing, a specimen under a glass slide in a pathology lab. When she leaves the room, she will probably go and wash herself meticulously and then do anything to flush the memory of Goto Dango's body out of her clean, virginal mind. He drifts away into a fever and sees himself from the vantage point of a mosquito trying to find a way in through the netting. A haggard, racked body splayed like a slapped insect on a wooden trestle. The only way you can tell he's Nipponese is by the strip of white cloth tied around his forehead. But instead of an orange sun painted on, it is an inscription. I-N-R-I. A man in a long black robe is sitting beside him, holding a string of red coral beads in his hand, a tiny crucifix dangling from that. He has the big head and heavy brow of those strange people working up on the rice terraces, but his receding hairline and swept-back silver-brown hair are very European, as are his intense eyes.
Jesus Nazarenus Rex Iudaeorum, he is saying. It is Latin. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews.
Jew, I thought Jesus was Christian,
says Goto Dango. The man in the black robe just stares at him. Goto Dango tries again.
I didn't know Jews spoke Latin.
One day, a wheeled chair is pushed into his room. He stares at it with dull curiosity. He has heard of these things. They are used behind high walls to transport shamefully imperfect persons from one room to another. Suddenly, these tiny girls have picked him up and dropped him into it. One of them says something about fresh air, and the next thing he knows, he's being wheeled out the door and into a corridor. They have buckled him in so he doesn't fall out, and he twists uneasily in the chair, trying to hide his face. The girl rolls him out to a huge veranda that looks out over the mountains. Mist rises up from the leaves, and birds scream. On the wall behind him is a huge painting of INRI chained naked to a post, shedding blood from hundreds of parallel whip marks. A centurion stands above him with a scourge. His eyes look strangely Nipponese. Three other Nipponese men are sitting on the veranda. One of them talks to himself unintelligibly and keeps picking at a sore on his arm that bleeds continuously into a towel on his lap. Another one has had his arms and face burned off and peers out at the world through a single hole in a blank mask of scar tissue. The third has been tied into his chair with many wide strips of cloth because he flops around all the time like a beached fish and makes unintelligible moaning noises. Goto Dango eyes the railing of the veranda, wondering if he can muster the effort to wheel himself over there and fling his body over the edge. Why has he not been allowed to die honorably? The crew of the submarine treated him and the other evacuees with an unreadable combination of reverence and disgust. When was he set apart from his race? It happened long before his evacuation from New Guinea. The lieutenant who rescued him from the headhunters treated him as a criminal and sentenced him to execution. Even before then, he was different. Why did the sharks not eat him? Does his flesh smell different? He should have died with his comrades in the Bismarck Sea. He lived, partly because he was lucky, partly because he could swim. Why could he swim? Partly because his body was good at it, but partly because his father raised him not to believe in demons. He laughs out loud. The other men on the veranda turn to look at him. He was raised not to believe in demons, and now he is one. Blackrobe laughs out loud at Goto Dango during his next visit.
I am not trying to convert you, he says. Please do not tell your superiors about your suspicions. We have been strictly forbidden to proselytize, and there would be brutal repercussions.
You aren't trying to convert me with words,
Goto Dango admits,
but just by having me here.
His English does not quite suffice. Black Robe's name is Father Ferdinand. He is a Jesuit or something, with enough English to run rings around Gotodengo.
In what way does merely having you in this place constitute proselytization?
Then, just to break Gotodengo's legs out from under him, he says the same thing in half-decent Nipponese.
I don't know. The art.
If you don't like our art, close your eyes and think of the Emperor.
I can't keep my eyes closed all the time.
Father Ferdinand laughs snidely.
Really? Most of your countrymen seem to have no difficulty with keeping their eyes tightly shut from cradle to grave.
Why don't you have happy art? Is this a hospital or a morgue?
La passion is important here,
says Father Ferdinand.
La passion?
Christ's suffering. It speaks deeply to the people of the Philippines, especially now.
Gotodengo has another complaint that he is not able to voice until he borrows Father Ferdinand's Japanese-English dictionary and spends some time working with it.
Let me see if I understand you, Father Ferdinand says. You believe that when we treat you with mercy and dignity, we are implicitly trying to convert you to Roman Catholicism.
You bent my words again,
says Gotodengo.
You spoke crooked words, and I straightened them,
snaps Father Ferdinand.
You're trying to make me into one of you.
One of us? What do you mean by that?
A low person.
Why would we want to do that?
Because you have a low person religion, a loser religion. If you make me into a low person, it will make me want to follow that religion.
And by treating you decently, we are trying to make you into a low person?
In Nippon, a sick person would not be treated as well.
You needn't explain that to us,
Father Ferdinand says.
You are in the middle of a country full of women who have been raped by Nipponese soldiers.
Time to change the subject.
Ignoti et quasi occultai societas eruditorum,
says Gotodengo, reading the inscription on a medallion that hangs from Father Ferdinand's neck.
More Latin? What does it mean?
It is an organization I belong to. It is ecumenical.
What does that mean?
Anyone can join it. Even you, after you get better.
I will get better,
Gotodengo says.
No one will know that I was sick.
Except for us. Oh, I understand. You mean no Nipponese people will know. That's true.
But the others here will not get better.
It is true. You have the best prognosis of any patient here.
You are receiving those sick Nipponese men into your bosoms.
Yes. This is more or less dictated by our religion.
They are low people now. You want them to join your low person religion.
Only insofar as it is good for them,
says Father Ferdinand.
It's not like those guys are going to run out and build us a new cathedral or something.
The next day, Gotodengo is deemed to be cured. He does not feel cured at all, but he will do anything to get out of this rut, losing one stare down after another with the King of the Jews. He expects that they will saddle him with a duffel bag and send him down to the bus terminal to fend for himself, but instead a car comes to get him. As if that's not good enough, the car takes him to an airfield, where a light plane picks him up. It is the first time he has ever flown in a plane, and the excitement revives him more than 6 weeks in the hospital. The plane takes off between two great mountains and heads south, judging from the sun's position, and for the first time he understands where he's been, in the center of the Luzon Island, north of Manila. Half an hour later, he's above the capital, banking over the Pasig River and then the bay, chock-a-block with military transports. The Corniche is guarded by a picket line of coconut palms. Seen from overhead, their branches writhe in the sea breeze like colossal tarantulas impaled on spikes. Looking over the pilot's shoulder, he sees a pair of paved airstrips in the flat paddy land just south of the city, crossing at an acute angle to form a narrow X. The light plane porpoises through gusts. It bounces down the airstrip like an overinflated soccer ball, taxiing past most of the hangars and finally fishtailing to a stop near an isolated guard hut, where a man waits on a motorcycle with an empty sidecar. Gododengo is directed out of the plane and into the sidecar by means of gestures. No one will speak to him. He is dressed in an army uniform, devoid of rank and insignia. A pair of goggles rests on the seat, and he puts them on to keep the bugs out of his eyes. He is a little nervous because he does not have papers and he does not have orders, but they are waved out of the airbase and onto the road without any checks. The motorcycle driver is a young Filipino man who keeps grinning broadly, at the risk of getting insects stuck between his big white teeth. He seems to think that he has the best job in the whole world, and perhaps he does. He turns south onto a road that probably qualifies as a big highway around these parts, and commences weaving through traffic. Most of this is produce carts, drawn by carabaos, big ox-like things with imposing crescent moon-shaped horns. There are a few automobiles and the occasional military truck. For the first couple of hours, the road is straight and runs across damp tableland used for growing rice. Gododengo catches glimpses of a body of water off to the left and isn't sure whether it is a big lake or part of the ocean.
Laguna de Bay,
says the driver, when he catches Godo looking at it.
Very beautiful.
Then they turn away from the lake onto a road that climbs gently into sugarcane territory. Suddenly, Gododengo catches sight of a volcano, a symmetrical cone, black with vegetation, cloaked in mist as though protected by a mosquito net. The sheer density of the air makes it impossible to judge size and distance. It could be a little cinder cone just off the road, or a huge stratovolcano 50 miles away. Banana trees, coconut palms, oil palms, and date palms begin to appear, sparsely at first, transforming the landscape into a kind of moist savanna. The driver pulls into a shambolic roadside store to buy petrol. Gododengo unfolds his jangled body from the sidecar and sits down at a table beneath an umbrella. He wipes a crust of sweat and dirt from his forehead with the clean handkerchief that he found in his pocket this morning and orders something to drink. They bring him a glass of ice water, a bowl of raw, locally produced sugar, and a plate of pinball-sized calamansi limes. He squeezes the calamansis into the water, stirs in sugar, and drinks it convulsively. The driver comes and joins him. He has cached a free cup of water from the proprietors. He always wears a mischievous grin, as if he and Gododengo are sharing a little private joke. He raises an imaginary rifle to his face and makes a scratching motion with his trigger finger.
You soldier?
Gododengo thinks it over.
No,
he says.
I do not deserve to call myself a soldier.
The driver is astonished.
No soldier? I thought you were a soldier. What are you?
Gododengo thinks about claiming that he is a poet, but he does not deserve that title either.
I am a digger,
he finally says.
I dig holes.
Ah,
the driver says, as if he understands.
Hey, you want...
He takes 2 cigarettes out of his pocket. Gododengo has to laugh at the smoothness of the gambit.
Over here,
he says to the proprietor.
Cigarettes.
The driver grins and puts his cigarettes back where they came from. The owner comes over and hands Gododengo a pack of Lucky Strikes and a book of matches.
How much?
Says Gododengo, and takes out an envelope of money that he found in his pocket this morning. He takes the bills out and looks at them. Each is printed in English with the words, the Japanese government, and then some number of pesos. There is a picture of a fat obelisk in the middle, a monument to Jose P. Rizal, that stands near the Manila Hotel. The proprietor grimaces.
You have silver?
Silver? Silver metal?
Yes,
the driver says.
Is that what people use?
The driver nods.
This is no good.
Goto Dengo holds up the crisp, perfect bills. The owner takes the envelope from Goto Dengo's hand and counts out a few of the largest denomination of bills, pockets them, and leaves. Goto Dengo breaks the seal on the pack of Lucky Strikes, wraps the pack on the tabletop a few times, and opens the lid. In addition to the cigarettes, there is a printed card in there. He can just see the top part of it. It is a drawing of a man in a military officer's cap. He pulls it out slowly, revealing an eagle insignia on the cap, a pair of aviator sunglasses, an enormous corncob pipe, a lapel bearing a line of four stars, and finally, in block letters, the words, "I shall return." The driver is looking purposefully nonchalant. Goto Dengo shows him the card and raises his eyebrows.
It is nothing,
the driver says.
Japan, very strong. Japanese people will be here forever. MacArthur, good only for selling cigarettes.
When Goto Dengo opens the book of matches, he finds the same picture of MacArthur and the same words printed on the inside. After a smoke, they are back on the road. More black cones coalesce all around them now, and the road begins to ramble up over hills and down into valleys. The trees get closer and closer together until they are riding through a sort of cultivated and inhabited jungle. Pineapples close to the ground, coffee and cocoa bushes in the middle, bananas and coconuts overhead,